And welcome to Standard Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're going to be talking to Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report. He's the executive editor, I'm told. And there's two matters we're going to talk to him about. One, his views on the current government in Kigali, Rwanda, and about which he speaks so eloquently, frankly. Second issue is this headline story we're sweeping over. It's the hashtag hunt for the girls in Nigeria. Margaret Kimberly, a Black Agenda Report columnist, freedom writer, she has written a really brilliant piece, and we're unable to speak with her, but since it's the Black Agenda Report, we're going to speak to the executive editor. And at the halfway point at 5:30, we'll be talking with Stephen Gowans of What's Left. Actually, I always make that a question. I'm sorry I get it wrong. It's actually What's Left. There's no question mark, so what's left? It's a very valuable website, and I hope that you folks will turn to it. He's got a piece titled U.S. Policy on Ukraine. Follow the Money, a Wonderful Old Idea. We all learned that. Was it during the Nixon years? Everybody said, you want to know what's going on with Nixon? Follow the money. And they got that from a pretty good lawyer named Williams. At any rate, we shortly will be talking with Glenn Ford. This is the Taylor Report. Mike, Phil Connors here. Phil, you have some news. Do you not? Betts Attune has something to say?
Yes, Betts Attune has a very interesting film this week. It's called The Great Book Robbery. It's presented by the Toronto Palestine Film Festival. It's a story that is not well known, but at the time of what the Palestinians refer to as the Nakba, Israel grabbed state power and turned Palestinians out of their homes, there was a huge raid of people's libraries, which are now the property of the Israeli National Library. And this film is about that story.
When and where?
And that will be at 7 p.m. on Thursday, May the 15th. It's called The Great Book Robbery. Mm-hmm. I think there's a $10 admission at Betts Attune, 612.
$10 Markham. Admission.
$10 admission.
Markham Street.
612 Markham Street. And I think the filmmaker will be there. So
the filmmaker is going to be there. Yeah. Okay. And the day again?
It's Thursday, May the 15th.
Thursday, May the 15th.
The Great Book Robbery.
Great Book Robbery. We want to call attention also, while we're waiting, we should have Glenn Ford soon, that we've lost, the world has lost Farley Mowat. And I noticed that there's a heavy focus on his fight for the environment, and many, many people, Dr. Suzuki and others, say that they were inspired by him. And that's all well and good, but I want to thank Canadian Dimension for bringing out another dimension of Farley Mowat, and that is that he was a vigorous opponent of U.S. World hegemony. And he became particularly loud and direct and clear during the Vietnam War, and deserves all kinds of credit for that, and because it took great courage. And that was his point of view from actually throughout his most of his adult life. You could call Farley in some sense a Canadian nationalist. That was part of his makeup. But he was a heavy opponent of imperialism. And you want to remember that Farley was a four-year veteran of World War II. When I say veteran, I mean they're shooting at you kind of veteran, the type who spent an awful lot of time hoping to survive heavy warfare. He fought in Sicily and he fought in Italy. And he was not enamored of the policies of the Cold War policies that emerged after the war. And I mention all of that because now we're entering into what they tell us is yet another one. And Farley Mowat was very much a voice against. And I really urge you to go to the books of Farley Mowat. But the way to start would be to go to the book And No Birds Sang, which is his account of being a soldier in World War II. And it is one of the, it will last. If people look back at the wars and study them, that book is going to be around for centuries. it's that important. I believe we're joined now by the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here, as yes. beckoned.
Well, thank you very, very much. I'm sorry it took us a moment or two to reach you. In the latest, on the site, I should say, the Black Agenda Report, there's a wonderful article by Margaret Kimberly, the Freedom Writer column, and it's titled, How Not to Bring Back Our Girls. And this is a front page story. They're calling it the hashtag story. I don't know why we were getting that. It's sort of an echo of previous dramas where there's an the implied question is, what is America and American power going to do to save these children? And Margaret Kimberly really goes after it. Could you outline what does Black Agenda Report see here in this story that should raise a caution flag?
Well, I don't want to speak for Margaret, but since we our thoughts are pretty much simpatico, I'll attempt it. Margaret is pointing out that this affair of the kidnapped young women is becoming a huge Joseph Kony kind of a vehicle for an expansionist and more aggressive U.S. foreign policy in Africa. It actually harkens back to all the propaganda over Darfur. And I remember very distinctly that the response of the black political class and just black folks in general who knew of had never heard of the place called Darfur before was, well, please, let's do something. There is genocide occurring in Darfur. And the situation was so clear-cut that there were no gray areas, there was no in-between, there was only the urgency that the United States come in and do something. Of course, what the United States wanted to do, Ms. Rice wanted to do, was to bomb, possibly, Sudan's capital city and certainly blockade her ports, actually go to war. And this was accepted among virtually the entire congressional black caucus as a rational, insane response because people did not understand the complexities of Darfur, that this involved desertification and conflicts between tribes of people who were all Muslims. But none of those realities escaped the kind of onslaught of let's go to war to protect Africans from genocide that was being synchronized by this administration. And so they did the same thing with Kony, resurrecting him from what probably was, if not death, certainly extreme political isolation somewhere in Africa. He has not been in Uganda, which is where his movement came from, in years. And yet when President Obama desired to put about 100 U.S. Special Forces into Central Africa, in Congo, in Uganda, in Central African Republic, and in South Sudan, he used Joseph Kony and his previous rampages as an excuse. And now the young women in Nigeria are similarly being used, and people are responding in the same way as they did to Darfur and to Kony.
Yeah, this is, of course, Glenn Ford, executive director of BlackAgendaReport.com. I think she points out there, it certainly is a consequence of this kind of stirring, and naturally they create almost like a time frame. Somebody has to do something. So long as they're talking about them, the anxiety grows. But one of the things apparently will grow out of this, based, I guess, on the Kony experience, is AFRICOM, right?
Oh yes, and AFRICOM, the newest of the U.S. military commands, has achieved miracles from a U.S. military standpoint in Africa since its official founding in 2008. AFRICOM is almost entirely coterminous with President Obama's tenure in office. So when we say AFRICOM, we're talking about Obama's leadership, what he has created in Africa. AFRICOM has succeeded, in fact, in reducing not just most of the supposedly independent states of Africa into vassals of U.S. foreign policy. All but two nations in Africa have reciprocal agreements of some kind.
Wow.
With the United States. Those two that don't have are Zimbabwe and Eritrea. But the African Union itself, which was envisioned in its previous incarnation as the Organization of African Unity, as being a vehicle for the political, economic, and military independence of Africa, AFRICOM itself is now just a tool, an annex of U.S. foreign policy. Its biggest so-called peacekeeping operation, that's nominally under the AU, is the Somali operation. That Somali operation is entirely paid for by the United States and by Europe, and even the U.S. corporate media says correctly that it is run directly by the CIA. And so we have the African Union basically fronting for the CIA and AFRICOM in Africa. So the AFRICOM's successes have been nothing short of miraculous in these last 6 years.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to a second issue I want to ask you about, which, and that is the U.S. involvement in Central Africa, in the Great Lakes area. And I want to ask what AFRICOM wants there, what the U.S. wants. This is in relation to the government of Paul Kagame. Now, I don't think we've spoken to you since this terrible incident where a former high-ranking officer of the RPF government of Kigali, who had gone into exile in Johannesburg, was strangled to death. And not only was he strangled to death, but in the immediate days following, when the subject came up, was that at the behest of the president of the country, Paul Kagame. But Paul Kagame himself and three or four of his ministers went out of their way to make really strange, macabre statements about Colonel Patrick Karegeya, who had once been their close comrade in arms, I guess. And the U.S. has not, in reacting to that, they had a tut-tut moment, but basically they all showed up on April the 6th, and Tony Blair was there. What's going on with Paul Kagame, and why this close attachment between Washington and London and Paul Kagame?
Well, Paul Kagame is a mad dog, and his assassination activities actually rival that of the Israelis in the 70s and 80s in terms of their frequency and their reach. He also has a propensity to make threats against much bigger countries than his own in Africa, with South Africa, for example, but especially with Tanzania, whose president, Kagame, has directly and physically threatened. But little guys like that don't sell those kinds of wolf tickets unless they have a very big brother behind them. And in fact, the Kagame regime is the product of U.S. imperial policy. It is the spawn of the Clinton administration. It could not exist without the actions of the United States in suppressing the very information of how in 1994, the presidents of Rwanda and neighboring Burundi died, and the intense fighting that led mm-hmm. to massive loss of life, first in Rwanda and then most disastrously in Congo, with the biggest genocide that the world has seen since the end of World War II, in which the United States is directly implicated. It takes a great deal of protection, repeated and assured protection for a little guy from a little country like that to to be acting like a gangster in a neighborhood like that.
Yes, and that, and that the two invasions with the massive, horrendous loss of life also led to a kind of both occupation for a time directly by the Rwandan forces and then through surrogates. And what is the, I assume there's an economic need there somewhere. What is it that the Britain and the United States are hoping to get out of there?
Well, isn't this quite obscene? We can look at it that on two ways. We read in the corporate media that Rwanda is such a shining example, a model for Africa. They talk about the little skyscrapers that are going up in Kigali, et cetera. Well, yeah, Rwanda's economy has gone through a remarkable change based upon the massive looting that's been going on in the Congo for going on two decades. That is, Rwanda and Uganda have basically become the middlemen and enforcers for getting those vital minerals out of the ground to their mostly Western but also Eastern corporate consumers, and they take their cut from the top. And that's why we see Kigali with its shining new buildings. It's kind of like we saw Miami's skyline go up too when it was the center of the drug trade of the cocaine invasion into the United States.
Well, it's an economic model.
This is Kagame and his clique are profiting from a purely criminal enterprise. Mm-hmm. You know, the United States, of course, and I think this is more important in the long run than just the extraction of Congolese and other African nations' minerals. I think it's that no minerals or energy exporting nation does not want to trade its resources. All of them want to be engaged in international trade. Nobody's trying to cut off these resources to these various countries. But there are corporations, of course, all profit-making corporations that want to buy them at the lowest possible price to super exploit. And in terms of U.S. policy, it's more complicated than that, in that the United States is an empire, and what is most important to the empire is not just daily mundane matters of price, but power. How does the United States maintain its position in Africa when China is now the biggest trading partner with Africa, and India is coming up, and Brazil, and all the BRICS, and some non-BRICS like Turkey? The United States it falls behind in terms of direct trade every month, and is not engaged in trying to change that equation. What the United States wants to do is dictate terms of trade and make sure that none of these nations that supply these raw materials will effect a geopolitical change, a different orientation in terms of politics, that they will be servants of the United States in international forums rather than with their major trading parties, who are not the Americans anymore. And to do that, they beef up these militaries all across the continent. AFRICOM is the key to that. They cultivate personal relationships, soldier to soldier, and that means general to general, colonel to colonel, yes, major to major, and down to the enlisted men, to the non-commissioned officers.
So they can back-channel communications.
It means that the United States, simply by whispering in a barracks that it may share with its Ugandan or Tanzanian or Nigerian counterparts. That's why the United States does not have, outside of Djibouti, any major bases. It shares bases with with the different African militaries so as to become closer to them. And so the United States can just whisper in the ear of its favorite generals and effect a regime change against either a, not just a civilian government, but against a military regime. They have that kind of tightness with that class. The U.S. brags on AFRICOM's internet page that it provides medical services to hundreds of thousands of the families of African military, of African soldiers.
That's more than they do for an American soldier.
That's more than they do for American soldiers. And in a place like Africa, this is a great bond that not only am I being taken care of, but my whole family is being taken care of by these U.S. military doctors. When the United States has its joint operations, and it has them with over a period of several years, it will have them with every single African country except Zimbabwe and Eritrea. These are all based on American terms, using American command and control equipment, and conducted for the purpose of greater fraternization and integration of these forces, so that the United States is losing the war for trade, if there really is any war at all. I don't think the Wall Streeters who are at the top in the West are really concerned that much about trade, but about the terms of trade. So if the United States falls behind China inexorably, further and further behind China in trade in Africa, it still maintains its grip on the guys with the guns. And that's what makes Kagame so important. And that's what makes Museveni in Uganda important. And that's what makes the dictators in Ethiopia so important. Those are the hired guns. They are the mercenaries of the United States in Africa. They're the ones who say, well, we're going, that the continent will be locked to the U.S. and Europe, that is, to NATO, in matters of foreign policy, no matter who it does trade with.
Well, that's a wonderful summary. We're talking to Glenn Ford, the executive director of BlackAgendaReport.com. I hope everybody will go to that site. That's a terrific summary, Glenn. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. One of the things that throws people off is they expect the United States to behave like imperialists of old, trying to set up huge bases everywhere every time they set their foot on somebody else's soil. But AFRICOM is much more sophisticated than that and much more dangerous.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. I really appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Glenn Ford, Executive Director, Black Agenda Report. Very eloquent man. And what a nice summary of the tricks that are afoot in Africa, both in the case of Mr. Kagame in Rwanda and why Tony Blair likes him so much, and, of course, the little psychodrama that is unfolding in Nigeria. And any student of Africa will remember, or I shouldn't say student of Africa, student of our own colonial policies, and we can't claim to be innocent of that. It's true we don't know anything about Africa, but we definitely know about our own colonial histories. And if you followed any American or Canadian or British administration, know anything about Winston Churchill, Harry Truman, Lyndon Johnson, you will find they have their hands in Africa. You're not exactly sure what their hands are there for, but you'll notice a lot of blood. On this program, we read from a memoir by a top CIA man in Kinshasa, Zaire, and we read the part where he said he had a visit one day from a professional assassin who told him he'd come to town, in order to get the logistical side of it worked out, because he intended to try to kill Lumumba, he detailed that. Now, a story like that gets told, and everybody just goes about their business. And by the way, they'll also couple it with saying, "Oh, no one really cares about Africa. We don't know." Well, they seem to know exactly what they needed to know, and they had reached a point where a central intelligence figure, who, by the way, gave his full name and told what his specialty was, was in town to kill a leader of the African country of Congo, Patrice Lumumba. Let us never forget Patrice Lumumba. You're listening to the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. And in a few minutes, about five, I think, we're going to be calling on Stephen Gowans of, I may have to see if I can how to learn how to say it. What's left? What's left? Not what's left, which I'm going to have to get. That's very. I'm sure glad he chose that as the name of his site. It gets some mind turning. I mentioned again that we lost Farley Mowat, and I'll just say, because I don't think I emphasized the title enough, And No Bird Sang is one of the greatest books written by a combatant that I've ever read. And it is the best book I've ever read. I've read Ambrose Bierce, I've read Stephen Crane, of course, who wasn't there, and various other memoirists and people, including the American Eugene Sledge, who wrote a book called The Old Breed, Story of the American Marines in the Pacific. Farley Mowat is a far more vivid and stirring account of the horrors of war. And he, by the way, added an epilogue saying, don't ever fall for that siren call. You know, the marching bands, big speeches, fluttering flags. He says, when you start stepping over the bodies, you know, it's a, he describes in that book being in battle, on a battlefield, and his commanding officer says, so-and-so group from Canada is arriving. They have not been in combat, but they'll be coming up this road. Go and meet them and hurry them up. We need them because, you know, we're being shot up. And so he goes down in a jeep to meet them, and he finds them marching along, and they're singing. And he said they're singing all the wonderful songs that they had been taught of going to battle and being brave and loving the country and the flag and the queen and the king and whomever. And then he said, as they got closer to the battlefield and the thunder of the artillery was beginning to deafen them, and as they began to see bodies, particularly the ones that had been piled like cordwood along the road, and he said the singing died out. And he said they became a little more grim. And then, by the way, the Canadian officer marching them said, all right, increase the interval. You're marching right behind the man in front of you. Increase the interval by 5 yards. And that would, and the reason you do that is to reduce the number of people who die when a shell goes off. Because if you're all in a bunch and a shell goes off, the bunch dies. So you increase the interval. And then Farley says, but the interval wasn't big enough because the shell did strike and seven soldiers, Canadian, were killed outright like that, and with many wounded. And by the way, your next job is keep marching. They don't say, let's stop and talk about this. No. Close the interval, hold your distance, and keep marching. We have to hurry up because, you know, the interesting part is still ahead. So you'll get that. Read that, Farley Mowat and No Birds Sang. We'll take a break, and we will come back. This is Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. We'll come back and talk to Stephen Gowans.